Another endearingly shambolic podcast from WeDigPodcasts.com.
Hi, we dig music, and because of this we've kept the music in our podcast at a low background level because we believe that you should support the artists by buying their records and going to their gigs. If you want to hear the songs in full, we've made Spotify playlists of all available music featured in each episode, which you can find on WeDigPodcasts.com. You can also join in the discussion on Facebook and Twitter by searching at WeDigMusicPcast. Finally, if you dig what you're hearing, please subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice, write a review if possible, and tell all your friends that you think would enjoy it. Anyway, enough of my yakking. On with the podcast.
And welcome to We Dig Music. I'm Tracy, and with me, as always, are my comrades and co-hosts, Colin.
Hello.
And Ian.
Hello.
So, this episode, we have reached the letter L.
Bloody hell.
And it's gone so quickly, hasn't it, so far?
Yes. It has.
Who is swallowing time?
I completely spaffed that joke. I meant to say bloody hell.
Oh well.
I should have started the intro with "Ello."
Nah. But the time has passed.
So let's carry on.
The time has passed.
As usual, we're doing a small band and a big band. This episode, the small band is Lieback.
But I think that's questionable, you know.
In this country,
in terms of people of how well known they are,
yes,
and venues that they play and record sales, they are.
But yeah. But on other stages...
In terms of
stages,
global
terms
political of impact.
Yes.
They're huge.
Yes.
Same with Fela Kuti in the previous one.
Yes.
Yeah. And for our larger band this time, we will be doing the LCD sound system.
The LCD sound system. LCD sound system.
Whatevs.
Boom.
So, Ian, would you like to tell us something about Lieback?
Just one thing. One.
Yes.
Yeah, or more. Go for more.
Okay then, I will. Slovenian avant-garde music group. Yes. Associated with the industrial, martial and neoclassical genres. I've got no argument there.
No, you can't. You can't. That's fairly accurate.
Formed in the small mining town of Trevolje, at the time in Yugoslavia, in 1980, Lieback represents the musical wing of New Slovensk Kunst. NSK.
Got to be really careful saying that.
Although I think saying they represent the musical wing would be a bit of a disservice, what with the fact that they founded the NSK.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So,
but they founded it along with a couple of other organisations. Like there's a theatre, there's a women's theatre group.
Yes.
And there's some like graphical art type people involved, none of which I've written the names down for.
Me neither.
Nor even I.
Amazing.
Yes, Lieback is the German historical name for the Slovenian capital Ljubljana. Itself an oblique reference to the Nazi occupation of Slovenia in World War II.
There will be quite a few Nazi mentions.
Yes, they constantly play on the whole totalitarian thing, but they are very much not.
No, but they never comment on it, as they never break character.
Yes.
So,
My favourite is that clip of the dude who's come from the gig and he's like, it seemed like it was neo-fascist, but I couldn't tell whether they were joking. Do you know? And then like further on, it's like, yes, I mean, I was listening to it and I didn't really know. I felt really passionate about a country that I'd never been to and I wanted to march.
I had this incredible subconscious urge to march.
But like, that's because a lot of their music is based on marching beats.
Yes.
Like, that's why. Come on, kid.
But I think he's already asking the question that we all need to know the answer to.
Are they serious?
Are they serious or not?
As a fucking heart attack. And not at all, I believe.
Yes. I've got a fantastic quote here when somebody was basically asking them if it was all a joke.
Yeah.
And they've said, we only practice the deadly serious kind of humour that cannot take a joke.
Yes.
Good answer.
On the... Because you can get a passport for the NSK state, which is a amorphous floating state.
So this
exists.
Is the second band that we have covered in two episodes that have their own state.
Yeah.
On there it says, artist fanaticism that demands diplomacy.
Mm.
I saw another clip where there's a guy explaining it. Using the metaphor for America in the 20s, like Southern America, is like, you've got all this very straight-laced picket fence thing, and then at night, they're burning black people. And that's an acknowledged thing that happens, but no one talks about it.
Right.
And that's what this, like, his metaphor for the Slovenian government and governments in general was. Like, there's the surface, and then there's stuff
really
that's happening
dark
that you don't talk about. Yes. And Liebach talk about that thing.
Yes, they're a deconstruction of sort of fascist ideology.
Yes.
And that they're very... See, we didn't get onto any... In the Joy Division episode, we didn't get onto any of the Nazi comparisons.
We didn't, and I've got loads written down.
But, so, obviously, Joy Division
is...
For people that aren't aware, was a... I don't know if it actually did exist or was just mentioned in the book House of Dolls.
Yeah, it's from a 1955 novella.
So, basically, it was a thing in Nazi concentration camps where it was women that were forced to have sex with the soldiers. That was the Joy Division. They also had various stuff like... Bernard Sumner put a picture of Hitler Youth on the front of one of their... early EPs.
Right.
I think it was the first edition of Ideal for Living.
Yeah.
Then obviously New Order has Nazi connotations.
Mm-hmm.
You've also got on the start of one of their really early songs, you've got Bernard Sumner screaming a number at the start, 350125 go, which is Rudolf Hess's prison number.
What the fuck?
So I think there's a lot of different people that make sort of Nazi connotations, but this might sound a bit snobbish, but if you've got the intelligence to pull it off, it works.
Yes.
If you just
trying to fucking show
Bernard Sumner,
and just trying to impress people.
Yeah.
Look at me, I'm fucking
exactly. Mm. The Joy Division were not Nazis.
No.
They were interested in the aesthetics and that kind of thing, but they. The stuff that they did was in such a fucking ham-fisted way sometimes.
Yeah.
And it was a better name than the Stiff Kittens.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the name, but the some of the other things, like the Hitler Youth...
Viciously pulling this back on track, because honestly, I could not give a fuck about this ham-fisted bollocks that you're talking about.
But Liebach do it in an intelligent way.
Yes.
They put so much thought into everything... That it is there as...
Also, they obviously have a way more communist agenda than they do fascist agenda.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is,
depending on your politics.
But they want everyone to get on and be happy and coexist. They had a dream of, Europa.
Yes.
They've got some really good ideals. The more I dug into them, the more I was like, God damn, man, I appreciate these dudes.
Yeah.
They're very intelligent. They've got a very similar political thinking to me.
Yeah.
Really. In that we're all just people and we should all just fucking get along.
Yes.
Right?
and they
orders are meaningless.
They said, we cannot concern ourselves with the fulfilment of other people's expectation of us. Our only responsibility is to remain irresponsible.
Yes.
And another brilliant quote from them. All art is subject to political manipulation, except that which speaks the language of the same manipulation.
Yes, that's the quote from the end of that documentary, isn't it?
Start of the North Korea.
Yes. They are also the only Western music act to ever play in North Korea.
Yes, they were invited to play North Korea in 2016?
2016.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
It was on the 70th anniversary of Korea's liberation from Japanese colonial
rule. Liberation Day.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic documentary. You should check it out.
Yeah, it is. I'll put a link to the version on the Internet Archive.
And
because the one on YouTube has the sound cutting off.
Yeah, if you aren't whistling the whistling hook from the song Whistleblowers by the end of it, this...
and so on.
Yes. So stuck in my head. Let's touch on the music of them, though. Because their music has definitely evolved in a very...
Throughout the career.
Yeah, I mean, you can still tell they're the same, because obviously Milan's vocals are so fucking recognisable.
Yeah.
Like, there's no one that sounds like him. There's Till Lindemann's trying, yes.
This is the guy from Rammstein.
Yeah.
Rammstein's logo is very similar to Liebach's logo.
Rammstein's fucking career
is very
similar. They
pretty much based their career on.
Yes. And,
on that sound.
Yeah.
They are doing it properly as well.
Yeah.
Like, they definitely play on the Germanic-ness of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, half of them are from East Germany anyway.
Yes.
Rammstein, so, you know,
they're old enough to have grown up.
They've lived it not quite the same way that Liebach lived it, because Liebach lived it in a very fucking tense...
Yes.
I mean, they got banned from their own country. Like, they couldn't perform in their own country.
They had, they played a gig in the early 80s where they had a video screen showing, that they used to show films and stuff, and it had got Tito, who's the dictator of Slovenia, who only recently, did he die just as they started in 1980?
Yes, very, yeah.
So they'd got video screens showing him and penises. Which the government didn't like very much.
No, because Tito was very popular.
Yes. So they were effectively banned.
You couldn't even say their name.
You couldn't say the name. It was the name Liebach was banned.
Yeah.
So they had to use this cross sign. So they used to be known just by this symbol.
Years before
Prince did it.
Yeah.
And the sign is this big cross.
Yeah, it's like
a fat cross. Fat stubby cross, I would call it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not quite the Red Cross cross.
Yeah.
It's much stubbier than that.
It's like the Red Cross if it had eaten loads and chopped off most of its arms and legs.
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
That worked in my head.
But yeah, you know, if you've seen the cross logo with the R in it that Rammstein have got.
It's like that, but with an R on it.
Yeah.
With the Rammstein thing, Liebach of basically they've talked about Rammstein's obviously acknowledged influence.
Yeah.
And they've put Liebach does not believe in originality, therefore Rammstein could not steal much from us. They simply let themselves get inspired by our work, which is absolutely a legitimate process. We're glad they made it, as they've proven once again that a good copy can make more money than the original. Anyhow, today we share the territory. Rammstein are a kind of Liebach for adolescents, and Liebach are Rammstein for grown-ups.
Nice. It's very true.
Absolutely. They do get on. Liebach later did a remix. It's sort of half remix, half cover.
Because it's Milan's vocals are on there.
Yeah.
I think Mina's vocals are on there as well, because
there's
female vocals, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it with Liebach's cover versions, though?
They
cover
like them.
Albums.
But they're a lot of them are used to make statements.
Very odd.
Yes.
Like the NATO album is filled with cover versions.
We're in the army now.
25, 25, 25, 25. Yeah,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
Well, the earliest one that I've not heard the first two albums, I don't think. I have heard the first one, but the first cover that really stuck out to me,
yeah,
because I wasn't expecting it, was on their third album, Opus Dei.
Yeah, that's the
or Opus Dei, possibly
the German language version of what's it?
Geburt einer Nation is the track title.
Yep,
which means birth of a nation.
Yeah,
which I started listening to. I was like, this sounds a bit like Queen. Mm-hmm. And then I realised that it was a cover of One Vision, sung in German.
Yep.
And it's fucking brilliant.
It is. It's really
insane.
Good.
It's insane.
That's Life is Life is on that.
It twice.
Yeah.
Which there's an English version and a German version, which was by a band called Opus, which is why the album's called Opus.
Ah, and but that's what they first got a lot of.
Yeah, that was a big hit.
Yeah.
That was their first record on Mute Records.
Yeah.
So their first two records were on quite small Slovenian indie labels.
Yeah.
And then they got signed to Mute Records in the UK, who Mute Records have Depeche Mode, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. They're basically your goth album of choice, goth record label of choice. I first obviously heard of them through their covers. Uncut Magazine seemed to be obsessed with them for a while.
Yeah.
Uncut Magazine quite often had cover CDs. Mojo did it as well.
I think Keith was telling me about them being in Uncut. See, I hadn't heard of Lieback at all, and I was chatting to him, thinking that he was going to kind of make fun of the fact we do a lot of metal-leaning bands on this podcast.
Well, they're not metal-leaning apart from on one album.
Yeah. It's industrial sound then, anyway. But anyway, he went, oh, yeah, Lieback, I've got a couple of their early albums. Yeah, I used to really, really like them. Yeah. And I was like, I didn't realise they're actually credible. They're very well known. And so it was just me that wasn't aware of them. So,
literally just Jesus Christ Superstars with guitars on it, isn't it? There's not guitars on anything else.
Well, there's guitars, but they're the only ones that I'd describe as metal guitars. But yeah, Uncut Magazine quite often used to have a CD where it's all covers of different bands. Uncut did it and Mojo, and they'd quite often both squeeze in a Lieback track on there. So this, I mean, Lieback did an entire album of covers of Sympathy for the Devil.
Yeah. And then the Beatles.
And then they did album as well. They did almost all of Let It Be, except they didn't have time to record Let It Be itself. So it's the rest of it. And I'm sure I remember Dig a Pony from Let It Be being on one of the Uncut CDs.
I was doing a computer repair course in college, and I rocked up in a Nine Inch Nails shirt, and my lecturer, Dom, was like, oh, you like industrial music then? I'm like, yeah, man, I like Nine Inch Nails and Ministry, yeah. And he's like, I'll do you a tape. And it had got, like, Front 242, Decrups, Lieback.
You've managed to mention Front 242 before, I did.
Yeah, and I was like...
Dude, what the and a Neubauten?
Yes, head cleaner.
Excellent.
Yes. I was like, what? Dude, what the fuck is this? This, fucking. It was the Sympathy for the Devil cover. I was like, what the fuck's going on with this? And he's like, yeah, Lieback, man. They've lived. Like, and he just gave me a brief potted history of them at that point. Yeah. I was like, fucking hell, these dudes really have. Like, they're from a very dark place.
Yeah.
And you can tell.
Well, Slovenia itself being in... It was Yugoslavia at the time.
Mm.
Obviously, they've had the civil war that they've lived through.
Well, they've played gigs just before wars have happened. On, like, three occasions, I think it was.
They're like the Harbingers.
They really are.
they're like... in Good Omens by Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman, you've got... you've got the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Yeah.
And war is... basically this woman that just keeps turning up in places that just suddenly have wars breaking out around her.
They do play up on that though, don't they?
Because
they're like on that electronic press kit video I sent to you, it said like they've recorded two songs that gave an eerie foreshadowing of the Two Towers.
Yeah, and that was bollocks.
Yeah, because they're both cover versions.
Yes. And it was like one of them had pretty much nothing to do with it anyway, and the other one, God is God, just mentions Towers Will Fall, which
yeah.
that was the other sort of first introduction I had to them, though, God is God, was on the soundtrack album to the Blair Witch Project.
Ah, yes.
A movie which has no music in it.
Yeah, because it was marketed as a mixtape, wasn't it?
Josh's Blair Witch mix. And it's basically one of the characters was apparently a goth. It was never alluded to in the film at all. But yeah, it's a really fucking good compilation album. And you've got stuff like Lydia Lunch, Bauhaus, Typo Negative. That got me into Afghan Whigs as well, because it's got their cover of Beware by Al Green, which is fucking amazing.
I purchased Jesus Christ Superstars because at the time, me and Colin, as we've covered, were DJing in a local pub, and I was like, oh God, I really want to play a metal cover version of Jesus Christ Superstars. It's amazing, and I bought it. But that album is the most fucking intense anti-religious album I have ever heard. Like, fuck all of the like black metal stuff, all of the Deicide albums. That is the most fucking vicious anti-religious album.
Yeah.
Because it's written from a very intelligent perspective.
It's the only one you could describe as metal.
Yeah.
It's listening to it, it reminds me of stuff like Frontline Assembly. The cover even reminds me of Frontline Assembly a little bit. The art style of that one.
Yeah,
it's not like Dave McKean, but it looks like it.
Yeah. It was that kind of point in time, wasn't it? But the one that I put on the playlist, Abuse and Confession.
Yeah.
It's all just from Judas's perspective.
Yeah.
Just fucking
isn't that the one that's got the lyric about I am the realist?
No, that's Message from the Black Star.
Oh, okay.
I expect nothing as such. No, this is the one where he just says over and over.
That's the same album, though, isn't it?
Yeah. He just says, like, your mission has failed.
Yeah.
You've failed the world. Like, whoa. The first time I clocked the lyrics to that, I was like, shit. Shit, that is bleak.
With all sort of the military sort of stylings and stuff, they use things like, on stage, they'll use, like, really military-grade lighting and stuff that.
One of their members is actually just listed as Lights.
Yeah, yeah. But they
and he is the main person that does interviews as well.
Yes.
Ivan.
Yeah.
Because Milan doesn't talk at all in any of the stuff I've seen.
No, so like it's just, it's a weird...
That's because they find out that he's actually in real life got a really high-pitched voice.
There's no way on earth that man could have a high-pitched voice.
Time for me to go on stage now.
Like, one vision.
like in a reverse scenario of Green Gartside from Spitability.
Has he got a really deep voice in real life?
Yeah, really deep voice.
Actually, have you heard Dave Perner from Soul Asylum speak?
No, I don't think I have.
He's got the slowest stoner kind of voice.
What, as slow as Joe Muscus?
No, because I could actually listen to him without falling asleep. But in the same kind of ballpark.
So, but the other thing that they use on stage is instead of using dry ice, they always use military-grade smoke bombs.
Yep.
Which, Ian, you've had a similar experience.
Ah, no. See, ours was a theatrical-grade smoke bomb, and it was a bad idea.
Ian,
because it was dust-based.
Ian did a tiny gig in the Arts Centre in Tamworth, really low ceiling.
This was also in an industrial band. So
in an industrial band, and set off this theatre smoke pellet right at his feet just before having to sing, and it basically choked him. It was hilarious.
I sang the entire gig,
including a cover of The Sun Always Shines on TV by A-ha,
which I actually,
you sang really well,
despite
not being able to breathe.
And then I got off stage and coughed my fucking guts up for literally an hour afterwards. Like, there was blood coming out. You have to suffer for your art sometimes.
Yeah.
Do you know,
not that much, though. Never again.
There was a live act song, actually, that made me think of Structures. Sorry, here we go again.
Every episode. That reminds me rather of Structures.
It was about the lyrics on B Machina.
Yeah? Which one's that? Oh, that's the We Are Departing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it made me think of your song, Volk.
Well.
And then later on, it turns out they've got a song called
Volk.
Yeah.
They've got an album called Volk.
Yeah.
Which is German for people.
Yeah. Well, I know that.
But I
That album.
And then and I was like, oh, God, shit, it was, I mean, was there meant to be a link, or was that coincidental?
It's, that was actually genuinely coincidental, because, right. The lyrical content is fairly similar. It's like about being a better person and achieving more as a people.
Well, that was totally the lyrical content.
Which is why that song
content.
Is called Volk.
Yeah.
Because it's... Volk is German for people, and
it's also nation.
Volky is Russian for wolf.
Ah, okay.
That's so, cool. And that was I did that on purpose.
I wonder if that's where werewolves come from. The fact that it's the same word. Perhaps that is proof that werewolves exist.
Maybe.
Science.
That's what Ulver, the band.
Ah.
Ulver is Norwegian for wolves.
Yes, I knew that. But yeah, that Liebach's album Volk is all sort of
national anthem
covers of or songs derived from national anthems.
Yeah.
So which they use as commentary
on.
They really understand politics.
Yeah.
Like, really understand it.
Well, going back to what you were saying earlier about the... they're basically sort of...
harbingers of doom?
No, the pro-communism sort of side of it. When they went to play North Korea...
Yeah.
Did you get to see the documentary?
Yeah, I watched it this morning.
Yeah.
Fucking amazing.
I watched it a week ago.
You've got... they were told that they weren't allowed to leave the hotel without a guide.
Yeah.
But one of them did.
Mm. It's never established who it is it? I assumed it was Milan.
No, it was
Ivan. He went AWOL, didn't he?
Is it Ivan?
Oh, yeah, that would... Yeah.
It was the guy with the glasses.
Oh, Ivan, yes.
Ivan, yeah. Because he was talking about it in the documentary. That he'd basically gone out for a walk.
Yeah.
And he... absolutely loved what he saw.
Yeah.
And how everybody seemed really happy.
That was the, it can't, there's so many things going around, it can't be staged.
Yeah.
I've seen so many people that it can't be staged.
Yeah.
That's not an angle you hear on North Korea.
No.
Ever, is it? The fact that they might actually be happy. The fact that communism might actually be functional. What a weird concept that is.
We're going to get shut down.
I don't know. Honestly,
we're going to get stormed by the government.
I don't care. I think it's a really good idea. So.
Well, so they were in. Well, were they invited?
Yeah.
Yes. The guy that produced the filmmaker guy that's part of the NSK, I think he is.
Yes, I think he is.
Had worked with North Korea on various other things.
Yeah.
And. As a result, they'd seen the video for the Whistleblowers.
Which is a fucking great video.
Which is really good, and invited them over.
But then it was really odd, because then they had a dinner laid on for them when they got there.
So they had a dinner lady there.
A dinner laid on by the Committee for Cultural Relations. And their director opened with a welcome speech. And the welcome speech went like this. Liebach are a terrible rock group. Their music videos use pornography. Indeed, this group is considered as neo-Nazi, sporting Hitler-style scenery and clothing. This band practically jokes and laughs about what they call dictatorships around the world, and their music is terrible. It is inconceivable that the DPRK, a staunchly anti-fascist state which fought against Japanese imperialism, which was an ally of Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, would invite a group such as Liebach to Pyongyang. If Liebach were to visit the DPRK, they would carry out a provocation and harm its socialist system. So without trust, without confidence, we cannot invite you here. And that was their welcome speech.
Yeah.
So
Liebach... They do things differently.
I couldn't work out whether he was just reading someone else had written it.
That's what I thought. So they smoothed it over, though, and they said, like, well, look, Liebach have been as much misunderstood by the world media as North Korea have themselves.
Yes.
They totally accepted this version of it and upgraded them to a new swanky venue.
He basically said, look at all those accusations there. Haven't you guys been accused of pretty much the same things? And they were like, oh yeah, fair enough.
And all this to a backdrop of South Korea and North Korea firing missiles at each other across the border.
There was only one bit of missiles. It was mostly they were firing music.
Yes.
They set the speakers up at the borders. Yeah.
Yeah.
So playing South Korean power or fucking K-pop at them.
K-pop at them, yeah. Which
it would have been amazing if North Korea had just started playing Liebach at them. Like, yeah, we've got these guys.
live, yeah. She was set them up at the border.
But it was weird because I really felt for them because they'd been invited to do this gig there.
Yeah.
But then everything got scrutinised. The lyrics, the...
They had to cut about
music,
half of their set, didn't
and they?
They
ended up just doing their covers from The Sound of Music.
And a few others. But yeah. It was
a very short set, though.
Yeah, it was like 6 songs.
Yeah.
But it's still fucking... Like, they still did it. And they're still the only band in the world to do that.
And so they were trying to do this cover of a really famous North Korean song about Mount Pyeongtaek, and trying to do it differently and sing parts of it in German rather
Which is
than,
what they do. They deconstruct and then rebuild the songs.
And I don't think they allowed them to do
no,
it.
No, they didn't.
No, because
what they said is, if you play it like that, the audience will get confused and angry and there'll be mayhem.
One of my favourite bits from the North Korea documentary was when they were interviewing some of the audience members, because they were showing clips of the audience while they were playing, and they were looking a little bit confused.
I love that long the long clip of the dude who looks like more and more fucking amazed as the clip goes on, and he's like,
so one of the audience members said, and it, obviously this was there was an interpreter's translating, but he said, there are all kinds of music. Now we know there's this kind of music too.
I think the bit that set the tone for the entire documentary and the band for me, right, is where the director guy sat there doing his interview. And then he's just goes, was that a goat farting?
Yes.
Because there's just, like, he's on a hillside with just goats and stuff in the background.
High on a hill with a lonely goat herd, in fact.
Yes. and a weird radar array.
Yeah.
Which is, like, it's where I imagine they live.
It's where you would go and hang out if you had the opportunity.
If I was in a band like Lieback and I'd got access to that, I'd be like, we live here now.
This is our house.
Just build some outbuildings, but I live in this top bit.
Yeah.
At the top, where all the radar is.
I liked the clip of the a bunch of Korean accordion players doing a cover of Aha's Take on Me.
Yes.
Well, that was
one of the things that guy had done.
Yeah, that was one of the other collaborations.
Yeah. Going on about the music evolving, their most recent album, Spectre.
It's fucking amazing.
It's so good.
We were listening to it before you got here.
Yeah.
Hey,
have you seen about the Spectre party?
No.
They've formed a speculative political party.
Ooh.
Wait, hang on, I've got something.
Okay. Well, while
you can buy... No, I'm there now.
You got it.
Well, getting there.
Nearly there. Take time.
You can buy the Spectre party book. Join Lieback on a quest to make the world a better place. With the release of the Spectre album, Lieback has decided to form an international party in order to create a possibility for an organised and synchronised international movement, helping to change the world wherever necessary and possibly, and to boldly go where no band has gone before.
Amazing.
Like North Korea.
Yep. So the Spectre Party Book is a symbolic document, a certificate of belonging for all those who want to join Lieback and actively support their mission to make the world a better place. I am probably going to buy it.
I tell you what, next time they play over here, I don't think they tour very often.
No.
When they do, we're fucking going.
Oh, God, yes.
We are absolutely there.
I went from really, really digging this band to absolutely fucking loving them now. It's like, I've just learnt about them and they're just amazing.
But yes.
Also, the soundtracks. They've done so many soundtracks.
Can we talk about them after the Spectre album?
Yeah, okay.
There's a track on there that...
Oh, God, yes.
Spectre came out in 2014. It was recorded and written in 2013. There is a track on there called Eurovision.
Yep.
The chorus is, Europe is falling apart. 2 years before Brexit.
Yep.
Motherfuckers are time travellers, I'm sure of it.
The ominous spectres of doom.
It's such a good album.
Yeah.
It's a really cohesive, poppy industrial rock album.
Yeah.
I wouldn't describe it as metal.
No, God, no. It's very mature, is what I would say. Very intelligent.
A lot of people are going to hear industrial and they've heard us talking about Nine Inch Nails and Ministry before and go, it's going to be really noisy.
Yeah, no, this is like...
Give it a chance.
Yeah, this is legit industrial, like the more electronic end of the spectrum.
Yeah.
With intelligent lyrics, political motivations. Not that Nine Inch Nails doesn't have intelligent lyrics, because I fucking love Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
I can see why people wouldn't like March of the Pigs.
I must admit, I'm not terribly keen on his voice, though. It goes a bit operatic, a bit over-dramatic. I can't get past it sometimes.
But it's amazing. If I could speak like that, I would.
I also saw a thread on the goth section of Reddit,
yeah,
where there was a list of songs that are ridiculously overplayed in goth clubs, and Tants Mit Lieback was the absolute top one. Because apparently, I've not been to a goth club for 14 years, something like that. And apparently, every fucking goth club everywhere, it's like Rage Against the Machine in rock clubs.
Oh,
right. You know.
Well, there you go.
Tants Mit Lieback, which is fucking ace. Really stompy. It's basically almost techno, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah.
So the soundtracks, you were saying, Ian?
Yes. Yeah, like they've done
Iron Sky.
Like back in the day, they did Hamlet, and they were in the production of that.
It's a lot of theatre soundtracks.
That's it, Macbeth. Sorry.
A lot of
they do loads
of tracks.
Fuck off.
Sorry.
Yes, you're right. You were right.
The journalist, sorry.
Thus Spake Zarathustra as well. Or is it? No, Also Spake Zarathustra.
Also Spake Zarathustra.
Yeah, which is...
Isn't it Nietzsche? I thought it was Nietzsche.
Possibly.
No, that's Thus Spake Zarathustra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's the 2001 Space Odyssey music, basically.
So they've done that, and Iron Sky, which is
about Nazis on the moon.
It's a great,
it's fucking brilliant.
It's a brilliant film. It's very schlocky. It kind of
is. It's a B movie.
It's definitely in their wheelhouse, though, isn't it? Like, yes. It plays with themes. It takes the piss out of everything, and it's done in an intelligent way, even if it is very B movie-ish.
Yeah.
They've done the soundtrack to Iron Sky 2, The Coming Race, as well, which will be out hopefully very soon, so that I get my autographed copy of
while.
It. I know, right?
It's been in the making for 7 years, something like that.
Yeah.
anything
else? Funded though, so you know.
Yeah. I think we're near enough done on that.
Yes.
Shall we talk about LCD sound system then?
Go on then.
Show you the ropes.
LCD Sound System is an American rock band, according to Wikipedia. I would say they're a sort of dance punk.
Well, throughout that entire documentary, they were referring to him as a rocker. When you're a rocker, there's only one way you can... Yeah. I hate that fucking phrase.
So, they're a... band in inverted commas, formed in 2002 by James Murphy.
Yes.
All the early stuff, it was just him. Basically, he put out... He was a DJ and producer and engineer. And then he started putting out his own 12-inch limited edition singles. On his own label, Death From Above.
1979.
That's why they have the 1979.
Ah.
They had a legal battle, and James Murphy and Tim Goldsworthy, which is his partner that does the DFA, or did do the DFA, they had a bit of a falling out.
Yeah.
They used the DJ together, and then they ran the label together. They had a legal battle with the band Death From Above, who changed their name to DFA. Death From Above 1979.
Yeah.
Also, they stopped calling themselves Death From Above in 2001, because they're a New York band and it had too many terrifying connotations after September the 11th.
Yes.
They basically started out as a DJ playing places like CBGB's.
Yeah.
So he was DJing to rock kids, but playing a lot of dance music and that kind of thing. And then decided to start making his own dance music, influenced by house music, but also things like bands like Gang of Four, Talking Heads.
Yeah.
So it's mostly stuff with real instruments as well as synths. So there's a lot of live drums as well as drum machines. but designed sort of to make people dance. Put together a band. They've had a lot of sort of lineup changes over the years.
A lot of people in it.
There's
well.
A lot of people in the band, but the main sort of constants, so the only two real ones that you cannot have the band without now, is Pat Mahoney, who's the drummer, and Nancy Wang, which is hilarious, on keyboards and vocals.
Yes.
I started getting into them not long after they fucking played Birmingham for the first time. They played the, I think it was the first Supersonic Festival at the Custard Factory in 2003.
Yeah.
Which, interesting, I was looking at the lineup, and do you remember Floach?
Yeah. The one-man band.
Floach was a guy that played the Battle of the Bands in Tamworth once.
Yeah, he had a song called awesome. Bitches, didn't he?
He did. He was a sort of weird electronic thing doing...
Did he win?
It was kind of dubby and stuff.
It was kind of dub gabba in parts.
It was really fucking good. I remember really enjoying it.
It basically, I think there were me and you that absolutely loved it, and everybody else in the room going, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Can we have another new
He did
one?
Not win.
He did not win at all. There's an audience vote.
I was going to say, otherwise we get back to this whole Battle of the Bands argument. Can a solo artist win Battle
no,
of
no,
the
that
Bands?
That was the thing, right? He countered that when he got through to the semi-finals by having a dancer.
Yes.
And he was like, I'm a band now.
Yeah.
Well, Smiley Mike should have done that.
Yeah. Well, because he won the Battle of the Bands.
I know, he won.
Won
but then
by being good.
But then they said, oh, but he's just, how can he win Battle of the Bands?
Pricks always complain when people win Battle of the Bands.
Yeah,
anyway.
Like,
he is brilliant.
He beat us. Yeah. I didn't fucking complain.
No.
Because he was good. He wrote good songs. And also he played a band's worth of instruments. So, you know.
Yeah.
Basically, so, a band. Acoustic solo artist.
LCD Sound System, and there were a load of other bands sort of surrounding them, like The Rapture and Radio 4 and people like that at the time in sort of 2003, 2004, 2005-ish.
Yeah.
That was my sound at the time. Every time I DJed, that is the stuff I was playing. I still do. I think when I very, very occasionally DJ now, it can sound a bit dated.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the stuff that I'm playing is from round about that sort of time. Things like House of Jealous Lovers.
This is the issue with my DJing as well,
yeah.
Because it relies entirely, very heavily on 90s stuff.
So,
but you know, that's when all the best metal happens, so
yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, I saw them live at Leeds Festival 2005.
Yeah.
Was the first time. I think that is where I properly got dance music. Iron Maiden were due to be headlining, well, did headline the main stage.
Yeah.
And I enjoyed LCD Sound System set so much that I spent the rest of the evening in the dance tent and ended up watching Milo as the headliner, who was really good, actually.
Yeah.
And I'd seen Maiden before.
But honestly,
looking back on it, I think Maiden were probably better on the day.
I would never miss Maiden.
But LCD Sound System was so good. They're an absolutely fantastic live band.
You see, they're one of them bands who I've always known, but not known at the same time. Well, somehow, before I did the research for this episode, I'd got them mixed up in my head with Public Service Broadcasting for some reason. I don't know why.
Okay.
I don't know if it's just LCD or PSB. I don't know.
Yes, it's like a similar sounding name, isn't it?
Yeah, that must have been it.
They've got they've both got electronic elements and
sampling
guitars and real drums.
Yeah, maybe. But I don't know why I got them mixed up. I mean, and I don't own any of their albums, and I don't know why, because they are fucking ace.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, their first album, there's a track on it called Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, it's on there twice. There's Yeah, Crass version, and Yeah, Pretentious version.
Okay.
It's amazing, that song, though. It's just pure bleepy heaven, isn't it?
It made me buy a synthesizer. I actually, purely on that song, went out and bought a Micro-Korg.
Wow.
Oh.
And started making electronic music.
I keep meaning to buy a Micro-Korg, but then I end up buying something else every time.
It's basically, it's about 9 minutes long, and it's the synth. It's got a really repetitive synth line that's sequenced, but he's just changing the frequencies with the filters.
Yeah.
So the cutoff and the resonance are just sort of sweeping throughout. And it basically is the indie version of
Higher State of Consciousness.
Higher State of Consciousness by Josh Wink.
I listen to it and I'm thinking, oh, this is the sort of music I could make. I could make this, and then I try and fail miserably.
Practice more.
So, you know, I need to make sounds like that.
Yeah. Well, you just get a drum beat set up, get a drum machine going.
Well, I have now.
Jam with it.
I've got a little set of called Volkers.
Volker beats, yes, of course. So do yourself an album, it'll be brilliant.
I know.
Get him to put it out on DFA.
Yeah. He probably would if we asked him nicely.
Maybe.
He's such a likeable character, Murphy.
He is.
Yeah, that's what I got from the documentary. Like, I felt that the documentary went on a bit too long, and I felt like I could have been doing that, because I've been really researchy the last couple of days. I feel like I could have actually done more valuable research, like watch the Fela Kuti documentary. But, you know, whatever, it's fine.
So the documentary that you're talking about is Shut Up and Play the Hits.
Yes.
Which was... So... LCD Sound System had released they released three albums. When they released the third album, it was announced that that was their final album.
Yeah.
They were going to do a world tour, and they were going to do this one final gig at Madison Square Gardens, which was enormous. They played like a over 3 hour long set.
Yeah.
And they made a documentary about the day before, the day of the gig, and the day after.
Yeah.
With all James Murphy's motivations for why he was splitting the group. Mm. And it's so well justified. He was relatively old when he started the band. He was in his mid to late 30s when they first started. So he was in his mid to late 40s at that point.
No, I think he said he was 41 at that point.
41, yeah. Yes, because he's now sort of mid to late 40s now. And he wanted to have a bit of a life.
Yeah, wanted to have like a family and stuff, didn't they?
And that kind of thing. And so they've had another album since then.
Yeah.
Basically, they did split up. They sold most of their equipment and that kind of thing. And then he realised, because when you're a musician, usually you don't stop thinking of music.
No.
You don't stop coming up with songs in your head. And he basically got so many songs kicking around that he needed to do something with it.
Yes.
And he could have either done a solo album, or he could have... But if he was going to do a solo album, he'd need a band to tour it.
Yeah.
And the people that he'd want to work with would be like Pat, Nancy and the rest of the band.
So basically, you might as well just do another LCD Sound
System. He could either do an LCD Sound System album, he could do an album under his own name with them in the band.
Which is an LCD Sound System.
Which is an LCD Sound System album.
Yeah.
In the end, he just decided it makes more sense to just do it as an LCD.
Yeah, I tell you, the bit that got me the most in that video, like, you know when he goes to the lockup and just looks at their stuff and then just has a little cry? I was like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
I was so sad for that, like, the 30 seconds that...
Yeah. But it's... I didn't listen to the new album when it first came out. I'm not going to go as far as saying I felt betrayed, which I know some people did. But I did. I felt it was such a good justification for stopping doing it.
Yeah.
So many bands just go on and on and just get worse as they fucking keep going. You know, not many bands that have been going for 20 or 30 years are still putting out their best work.
Yeah.
But then I thought about it a bit more, and like I just said, if you're a musician, you're going to keep...
I'm going to take a leap here, right, and say the people that get mad at bands for either changing or splitting up or breaking a promise that they've said they've made don't play musical instruments.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Like, if you aren't a musician, you can't possibly understand the way a musician
you have
looks
to fucking
at their
do
band.
It. Exactly. So, I mean, and then when the album came out, on my first listen... I didn't really dig it that much, so I only gave it the one listen.
I bet you love it now, though, right?
I do. I really do. But it took me a year. I didn't buy it. I still don't own the new album. I'm going to get it.
Yeah.
But listening over the last couple of months, it is fantastic.
Well, he put a statement out on his website.
To justify
point,
his reasons.
Yeah, when they were getting back together. And he said, I was fully prepared for a certain amount of, oh, fuck that guy, over it stuff. And in fact, he welcomed it. He said, it's strangely energising to have people who don't make music themselves take pop shots at you on the internet. And but then he had this really interesting thing that he said, because he said he understood people who thought it was a good idea for him to get back together. He understood people who thought it wasn't a good idea. And he said, it's your right to define what you love about a band, and it's your right to decry their actions and words as you see fit, because it's you, frankly, who have done much of the work to sustain that relationship, not the band.
Okay.
And I figured that's a valid way of looking at it, and I feel like that about a lot of bands that...
that learned how to play their instruments, got good producers.
Burn.
Say something.
I always think with bands that the music belongs as much to the fans as the band, and it is your right to, yeah.
See, yeah, Lydia would agree with you, because she really, really doesn't like it when bands play songs slightly differently live, because she likes to sing along.
This is exactly my point.
The Garbage gig that we went to recently, When I Grow Up, they've done a new arrangement of it, and I was disappointed because I was really looking forward to singing along. And the verses, I didn't realise what it was until halfway through the verse. I was like, hold on.
Yeah.
It was good, but it wasn't the version that I wanted to hear.
I understand it from both directions.
Yeah.
Like, if you're playing the same song and you want to sit, if you want to do it differently to keep it interesting for yourself as a musician, you have every right to do that. But as a fan, you have every right to be like, oh.
But that Garbage gig was a 20th anniversary of the album, so was there for nostalgia.
Yeah, you know what you're doing.
So that's a different kind of thing. But at the same time, you've got bands like Eels that change the style of music that they play every time they tour.
But I guess if you know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
Well, I've always had this beef with Mark Eitzel when he plays live. And he did a tour where he took a lot of the American Music Club material and then did this bizarre piano jazz tour of it.
We've established, you fear jazz.
Yeah, I do. But then at the same time, you might say, oh, well, that's the arrangement I know. I like the song as it was on the album.
But then you've got the album for that.
Well, however, that arrangement that appears on the album was probably just a one-off arrangement that they did when they recorded it. The artist who's singing it has probably never sang it like that before or since.
It's probably
a much looser arrangement.
I think part of the dance kind of sound that they've got is from him being a DJ, first of all.
Yeah, yeah, definitely, because he's got that rhythmic sensibility.
And you've got the... In Losing My Edge, which was the first single.
Yeah.
Such a cool song.
It's brilliant. It's almost like sort of spoken word.
Yeah.
With a beat behind it. But one of the things that is most of it is sort of outlandish claims, like claiming that he was, he was at the first Cannes shows in a loft.
It's a pissing music set to dance music.
Exactly. I've got a verse here. But I was there. I was there in 1974 at the first suicide practices in a loft in New York City. I was working on the organ sound with much patience. I was there when Captain Beefheart started up his first band. I told him, don't do it that way. You'll never make a dime. I was there. I was the first guy playing Daft Punk to the Rock Kids. I played it at CBGB's. Everyone thought I was crazy. That last one
is absolutely true.
He was the first person playing dance stuff other than Prodigy and that kind of thing.
The bit about don't do it that way, you'll never make a dime. A friend of mine on Twitter, Only Memories 7, had that line in his Twitter bio until recently.
Excellent. It's a good line.
It's a great line.
His lyrics are fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, one of...
All to a brilliant Casio bossa nova groove.
It's a bit harder than just a Casio one. It's a bit more hard hitting than that.
My Casio sounds like that.
I don't think you've got quite as big a kick,
No.
Lyrically, they're so good. I've thought of them in quite often as being like New Order, but without shit lyrics.
Ah, yeah.
Because his lyrics are so, so good in a lot of cases. There's a line in Drunk Girls. Drunk girls know that love is an astronaut. It comes back, but it's never the same. That is a good lyric.
The video to that is insane. It's got a Spike Jonze video.
Yes.
Love that video.
There were a load of people... mostly like sort of rabbit mask type things.
Yeah.
There are a load of people dressed up like that at the final gig.
They
asked people to dress in white for the gig.
Yeah.
And most people seem to have done it, which is pretty cool.
See, I haven't seen that documentary because it's not on YouTube.
It's only on Blu-ray. You can get it. I've only got it on Blu-ray. Yeah. You haven't got a Blu-ray player.
And you lent it to Ian anyway, so.
That's because you haven't got a Blu-ray player.
But, well, I watched a really cool interview with him.
Was it Red Bull?
Yeah, the Red Bull Music Academy.
Where he was going through songs that he liked and just talking about them.
Yeah. In fact, he started off with the first two songs he bought when he was young, were Gilbert O'Sullivan's Alone Again Naturally and David Bowie's Fame. And he said his whole life has been an argument between them two songs ever since. That sums his life up.
Harmar Superstar covered Alone Again Naturally, which is the first time I ever heard the song. It was on one of his albums when I worked at the record shop years ago.
You know, I reckon James Murphy looks like a cross between Guy Garvey and Robin Guthrie.
I can definitely
see that. Cocteau Twins.
Yeah.
I'm not entirely sure he would be happy about that. If someone said I looked like Guy Garvey, I'd be like, thanks.
It wasn't an insult. It just does.
He just does. Yeah.
He doesn't look like a rock star at all.
And Tracy fancies Guy Garvey, so that's not an insult coming from Tracy.
I quite fancied Robin Guthrie in his day.
I bet you fancy James Murphy as well.
He looks very huggable.
His weird middle-aged man kind of...
Admittedly, he does look like he would give nice hugs.
He does.
he's such...
He does look like someone's dad.
Yeah. Which, nothing wrong with looking like someone's dad. I'm one of them.
You don't look like someone's dad.
And he doesn't look like my dad because he's not a lot older than me.
I think one of the things that, reasons that it speaks to me so much is that he's...
Can I point out that all of the note shuffling sounds you'll hear in this episode isn't me for once?
All of it isn't you.
All of it isn't.
None of it isn't me.
None of it isn't you.
It's all Colin.
That was me
dropping my notebook.
Honestly, Tracy, the journalist. Have I just picked apart your grammar like a bunch?
It was intentional.
Yes, oh, all right. Of course it was. He's such a big music fan. Mm. You could not ever describe LCD Sound System as being a particularly original sounding band.
No.
There are so many of their songs are, you know, there's tracks that you listen to and go, okay, well, that's their version of Bowie's Heroes.
Yeah.
You know, that's their version of, Depeche Mode track.
They've got Movement, which is their version of The Fall.
Oh, Movement. I was listening to in the car the other day. That's a fucking dangerous song to listen to when you're driving.
Yeah.
It is impossible to stay under the speed limit. Although, actually, the other day it was nearly quite dangerous because I'd got it on in the car when I was with Ian yesterday and we nearly reversed over a load of brownies.
Yes. Not the
in
cakes.
In a car park in Tamworth.
Not the cakes. No, the young women.
Small female scout kids.
So, it was bad.
But yeah, it does make you drive incredibly fast. I wasn't driving incredibly fast in a car park reversing at that point. But
otherwise, it wouldn't have been nearly.
That would have been, yes, I would have.
Would have been absolutely.
It would have been on the news. You'd have known about it if that had happened.
Yep.
I didn't kill any young children.
James Murphy made me do it.
Do you know, I think their more recent stuff, actually, is sounding more Arcade Fire. His vocals sound very Arcade Fire.
I did think they'd got a big Arcade Fire thing going on, but obviously they are interrelated.
They are. They're really good friends.
They're on that DVD as well, aren't they?
Are they?
Shut Up and Play the Hits.
Yeah.
The reason that the documentary is called that is because that's what Win Butler shouts at him when he's halfway through a speech in the final gig. Because that gig, they'd got Arcade Fire on backing vocals at the side of the stage. And he, James Murphy, produced a lot of the Reflector album.
Yeah.
Right.
He's also done some really good remixes. There's a Optimus Bowie, David Bowie remix of one of the songs off not his last album, the one before. What's the one that's got the Heroes cover with it? The Last Day. No. Next Day? one of them. I've completely blanked on it. But yeah, there's a really good remix that he did on there. And he, you know, he produced all the stuff, like all the, with the DFAs and loads of remixes of like Nine Inch Nails songs.
Yeah.
Hand That Feeds DFA mix. And he's worked with bands like The Rapture producing them. House of Jealous Lovers is one of his. He produced that whole album and it's really, really good.
Yeah.
Do you know, there's a link to Gregor Samsa, I think.
What? Is there?
Mm-hmm. Who did that album called 5512, which is 53 long.
Are you saying that because they've got an album called
4533?
Right, and it's not 45 minutes 33.
It's 4558.
Right, that's a very fucking tenuous link.
I said it was tenuous.
That is the most tenuous link of we've ever had in this podcast.
I win.
Because it's a Steve Reich reference. Not Steve Reich. John Cage reference.
Ah.
Because it's a reference to 4 minutes 33. It's 45 minutes 33.
Actually, Murphy said later he just wanted to make some longer music.
He did.
And he...
No, that... Okay, what you've...
And
missed,
he said
no,
akin
hold on,
to...
Hold on. You've missed something there. The story for that album, the 4533, was that he was...
It was a Nike thing.
Was that he was commissioned to make a song for Nike.
Yeah.
Actually, no, he just wanted to make longer music and he put that story out.
And it was akin to something called E2 to E4 by Manuel Gotching.
Okay.
Which was 58 minutes 40.
Right.
But E2 to E4 is a chess move, apparently. Well, is a chess move and also a reference to guitar tunings.
Yeah.
So.
I think that probably is the.
Lots more really random, irrelevant facts. Sorry.
Yeah. He's done some really cool stuff, or tried to work on some really cool projects. He was working on a project at one point where in the New York subway systems, when you go through the barriers, it beeps when you put your ticket through.
Mm.
And he was trying to work on a project where they're all putting out different beeps but in harmonies to each other. So throughout the day, as people are going through there, it would make different tunes and you'd have slightly different scales at different stations.
Mm. That sounds quite cool.
And he got really far along doing it until it got pointed out that the reason that they have that exact beep is to help blind people. So he couldn't go through and finish it off, which is a shame because they were really close to actually implementing it. And that'd be awesome.
You'd think that's the kind of thing someone would point out relatively soon.
Yes, you'd hope so, but I think it was quite late on in the...
It's one of those late-stage common sense checks that people like me do.
Here's another random fact.
Like, I assume you've already thought about this, but... And then someone's like, no! Shit!
Sorry.
Ruiner.
Another random fact. His first band were called Great... And he said that was so we could go on stage and say, hi, we're great.
Yeah, this is why I was in a band called Sheet.
Yeah. It works both ways. Yeah, that's cool. I like that.
Do you know what? In that interview, that Red Bull Music Academy, where he was just playing songs that he thought were cool and then talking about them, he played a Can song. And I thought it was pretty cool, and I'm wondering if
that's because Can are pretty.
Have I finally had my Can epiphany?
Do you remember which song it was?
It was I'm So Green.
It's not one I know very well.
And I haven't heard it before.
Have you listened to Moonshake?
The band?
No, the song by Can.
No, I haven't. I know the band Moonshake.
I think you'd like it. It's about 3 minutes long.
Wow.
Maybe even 2.5 minutes long.
I will go listen.
Are played really sloppily.
That doesn't sound like Can.
It does sound like something you'd like, though.
It does. It does.
There's a like a partnership kind of thing. You know, with the Arcade Fire thing that he works quite closely with Arcade Fire, there is another band that he's a lot closer to. He's kind of like had a parallel career with Soul Wax.
Right.
So
because they are also DJs.
Exactly. Mm. Soul Wax started out as DJs in Belgium. They got to meet each other and started touring together. They have like band members appearing on each other's albums. Like Nancy Wang is on some of their records and that kind of thing.
Is Soul Wax the Too Many DJs thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Soul Wax go out DJing. Their DJ project is called Too Many DJs. Hmm. And they play loads of mashups and stuff. So James Murphy ended up DJing quite a lot with them.
Right.
They remix each other's records all the time.
Yeah.
What they've done most recently over the last sort of 5 years or so, they've got this thing called Despacio, which is, it's a touring club that goes to festivals.
Oh.
And it's basically, it's a really dark room.
Yeah.
And they've set up really high-end speaker cabinets surrounding the room. So there's like seven of them in surround sound.
Yeah.
And it's designed, he basically got fed up of this DJ culture where the DJ is the focus.
Mm.
And they're like, the DJ's on a stage and everyone in the audience is watching the DJ and not even dancing.
Yeah.
Which is stupid because he's playing someone else's record.
Exactly. So what they do is they're in there DJing, and it's James Murphy and the Diwali brothers from Soul Wax.
Yeah.
And they are in there DJing. It's totally on vinyl, but they're sort of the end of the room, and it's not very light where they are. It's kind of dark.
Yeah.
And the whole thing is focused on just the music, and they'll play for like, between the three of them, they'll do like 8 hour long DJ sets. It was at Glastonbury a few years back. I'd never made it to it when I was at Glastonbury.
Yeah.
It was one of the really fucking rainy ones, so as that was a covered tent,
it was rammed.
They were queues to get in the whole time. But then it was at All Points East Festival this year that I went to, and we went in for a bit, and it was ace. They were playing loads of old like funk and disco sort of tracks.
Yeah,
and it was really, really good. But loads of people in there having a really good time, and admittedly, what they've said is they don't want the DJs to be the focus, but I did have to go to the window so I could watch.
Yeah.
It's like, there's James Murphy, who I'm a massive fan of.
Yeah.
LCD Sound System are, they're up there with my favourite bands. There's, I mean, particularly All My Friends, which is off their second album, that is in my, definitely my top five favourite songs.
Such an anthem, isn't it? Such an anthem.
It's got some of the most relatable lyrics. It totally sounds like a New Order song, but with great lyrics. You know, it's got Peter Hook style bass all over it.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lost New Order classic.
That song just makes me sort of feel happy and sad all at the same time. It's,
well, I remember seeing them at Glastonbury probably about 9 years ago now, something like that, playing that song as the sun goes down, with like a few of my best friends standing in this field in, it was like a really hot blazing sunshine, Glastonbury, and that was one of the best like festival experiences I've ever had.
Wow.
But it's the lyrics in that song are so like bittersweet, because it's totally about growing old and like losing touch with some friends and stuff, and not being able to go out like you used to. You know, you spend the first 5 years trying to get with a plan, and the next 5 years trying to be with your friends again, which is absolutely brilliant. It's fucking beautiful, that song.
Oh, and I have a new favourite Christmas song.
That would be their comeback single.
Yeah, Christmas Will Break Your Heart from 2015.
Of course, because it ticks the Tracy boxes of, it's a Christmas song, but it's really fucking depressing.
Yeah. It's a Christmas heartbreak song. It's beautiful. Like the Low Christmas album.
Excellent. I think we're probably round about done there.
I reckon so.
I think so.
So, next episode is the episode where we will be discussing the letter M. So, who are we talking about?
Mastodon.
We're not, no.
Metallica?
We are. We're talking about Metallica and Mogwai.
Oh, yeah.
I'm amazed that it's taken us till the second series to talk about Mogwai.
Yes.
That's going to be probably a fairly positive one, I think.
Yeah, I reckon so.
I think so.
We've been Weedic Music. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.
Why do I keep saying boom?